So we are recording this. We are required to record everybody, all the participants. So if you would pretty please, instead of saying your name, that kind of thing, if you could type your first and last name into the chat so that we can just record this. We're still, it looks like we're still accepting folks into the meeting. So we'll just wait a few minutes here. I want to give everybody the opportunity to get logged in. Good morning for those of you who are just joining us. This meeting is being recorded. So we are required to document all participants. So if you could pretty please type your first and last name into the chat instead of, we won't do introductions because we just have way too many people. And I am going to type my name. Running really slow for me, maybe because we've got so many people still being admitted. What 131? Thank you, everyone, for putting your names in. Really appreciate that.
Really appreciate that.
I am hearing feedback from somebody, so if you guys could be sure to mute your mics, I would appreciate that. Thank you. Okay. So I am going to go ahead and get started. Hello. Welcome to our webinar today. My name is Debbie Dunn, and I am the Data Sharing Program Manager. As I stated, this is being recorded. So please be aware of that. We are going to be able to share this recording later, in case anybody needs to get a copy of it. If Eric, if you could help me manage the admits, thank you. We are asking everyone to type their name into the chat. We are required to record participants' names. And looks like we might have a few people on the telephone as well who won't be able to type their name in the chat. But I think we'll have those numbers recorded as part of the recording. So, all right. So, they're still coming in. Okay. So I've never done a webinar note. So I'm looking at three different screens, and I apologize for if I'm not looking you straight in the eye. But first of all, welcome. I am amazed by the turnout. This is far more than I expected. We will have another webinar tomorrow. I believe it's at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that information is out to you. But before we go through all of that, let's go ahead and just do a couple of introductions. For those of you who just joined, I am Debbie Dunn, and I'm the Data Sharing Program Manager here at DOL. Eric, can you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi everyone. Eric Shields, Compliance Manager, DOL. Thank you.
And James, please.
Hi, good morning. I'm James Messer. I'm the Contracts Manager in the Data Management Office.
Thank you, James. For those of you who haven't realized yet, Matt Lewin, who was our previous contract manager, has still here within DOL, but he's started a new data stewardship program, and he's getting up and running. So James is our contract manager. And certainly last but not least is Alex. Are you on here today somewhere?
Yes, I am.
Great.
Experiencing some bandwidth issues, so I'm unable to share my video. But I'm Alex Bolak. I'm the admin assistant for Fred Wade, the director of OPA.
Thanks, Alex. Alex is going to play a key role for us today, and he's going to record comments and questions for us. Because what we're going to be doing is out of both this session, tomorrow's webinar, and any questions or comments that are submitted to our group mailboxes, we will be developing a FAQ. And I just lost my screen. What are you guys seeing? It looks like I'm seeing.
I can see your email. Yeah.
Okay, that's not my email. Did someone take control? Someone took control, so we're looking at somebody's email. Please relinquish control. Okay, let's try this again. I'm going to try to present again. Anyway, as this is coming up, are you able to see my screen again?
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, what I was saying is we're going to do a FAQ of sorts, and be distributing that out probably as updates as go as well. I was really hoping to have kind of a website that we could just post this on, stuff on, and things could get people could self-serve themselves on the FAQs and attachments and things like that. We just weren't able to do that. So as our FAQ gets updated, we will be sending that out to the contract administrators or managers, and for e-services, the administrators on a regular basis, so that you guys will have all that information. I'm sorry, it looks like I've lost. I jumped ahead on the pages, unfortunately, when I somehow lost control of the screen. Okay. So, first of all, we're just for the agenda, we're going to have an introduction to WACS, which is the acronym for Washington Administrative Code, which are administrative rules. Then we will have a brief overview of the new contract template. And Eric will go over the changes to the compliance in there, in that template. We do want to save the bulk of the time for the Q&A, so our presentations will be at a fairly high level, because we do want to hear your questions, comments, that sort of thing. And then James is going to do just a kind of a closing comments and summarize for us. So last year, Substitute Senate Bill 5152 passed in the legislature. It is a bill that was specific to DOL, and it created a few new statutes, which are there on the screen. And it also updated some of the permissible uses, both for abstract of driving records as well as vehicle owner information. And so you need to be aware of those and go look at that statute if you haven't already. The bill also authorizes DOL to make additional requirements. So in that statute, under 4622010, it does say some specific things that DOL is supposed to do contractually, and then gives us the authority to make additional contract requirements. And that's what this WAC process and the contract template are all about. For the most part, well, okay, I'll go into that first in a minute here. I don't want to jump ahead of myself. The law actually went into effect in July, but with the rulemaking that we're doing and getting stakeholder input on our contract template, we are anticipating that the draft or the WACs and the contract templates will be effective November 1st of this year. This is the first time we've done rulemaking for this, and also for a broader stakeholder input on our draft contract terms and conditions. So we're really excited about this because we really want your input. We are trying to balance, we have a responsibility to the residents of Washington to protect their personal information. But yet we also want to balance our requirements with business needs as well, or concerns that our business partners have. And so, so that's what we're trying to do with this brand new process. We're very happy to be doing this. I've been wanting to do it for several years now, and this is the first opportunity we've actually had to do it. So, and this will be the first opportunity where everybody will be on the same contract terms and conditions as well. So as you're reviewing the draft WAC and the contract terms and conditions, we're asking you that if something seems overly burdensome, before rejecting it, summarily just rejecting it, we're asking that you look at the rationale for that clause. It could be that maybe we didn't word it right, or we could have worded it better, that kind of thing. So with that documents that we send out with the WAC and the contract template, there's a table in the opening pieces of those that I believe it's the right-hand column that kind of talks about what our intent is here. And so when providing comment back to us, we ask that that you cite the specific clause or section that you're referring to that will help us understand exactly where you're focusing on. Help us to understand your position and why you have a concern for it, or why you're suggesting the change, that kind of thing, so that we can kind of understand and see from your perspective that's what's going on. And we may also then want to call you and maybe have a conversation to understand that further. Again, we will be developing frequently asked questions and distributing that throughout the course of this process. So Washington Administrative Code, I don't know your guys' familiarity, but we have statute that is enacted by the legislature. Then agencies have authority to do what we call rulemaking or make administrative rules. And those have basically the same force and effect. of the statute. And so our purpose here in rulemaking is to codify and kind of fill in the gaps to implement the law. And at a high level, the processes and procedures that DOL will follow in sharing protected personal information. Now, that's a new term, which I will go over with here in on the next slide. And for the our purposes here, it'll be very high level. And again, I will refer you back to that chart, that table that we provided with the WAC for the intent of each section, what we're trying to do there. But there is a couple of things that I would like to go over. I need to apologize. My cat is meowing in the background, and if you hear her, I apologize. She likes to participate. So anyway, so there are a few things. The definition section we have, I believe there's 21 definitions. The term personal protected information, because we have defined personal information in WAC as well as identity information in WAC, we just combined those two terms into protected personal information, so it means both. We have also a new term, customer. Customer is someone who an agent or a recipient may be requesting the data on behalf of, but doesn't actually provide the data to them. They just process the data on their behalf. There will be a requirement in the contract that when submitting, for example, your subrecipient list, it's now being expanded to include customers as well. We feel that our Washington residents have a right to know who is getting their data and using their data. So that's what that is for. And then there are some terms that are almost interchangeable. And so I wanted to kind of display it here in this table. The term recipient is not new. A recipient is anyone who gets data directly from DOL. They could also be an agent acting on behalf of somebody else to pull the record, or they could be just the requester themselves. And the requester is the person that has the actual permissible use. In an example of our e-services, we have some businesses that can just pull an ADR down, download for themselves. That would be a requester and also a recipient. The subrecipients, sorry, I need to tuck in my cat here. Sorry about that. The subrecipient is someone who receives the personal information or the protected personal information from a recipient or an agent. They also can be an agent, and they can also be the requester. So our new legislation allows for multiple agents. So for example, which didn't happen before, but for example, Bob's Pizza has hired an employment agency to hired some drivers and manage their driving records, for example. That employment agency uses a data broker who pulls the data directly from us. So the data broker is the recipient. The subrecipient may be the agent or the requester if Bob's Pizza also ends up with the data, or Bob's Pizza could be the customer if they don't actually get the driving record. And so the agent can just be the recipient, and they can also be a subrecipient. And then requester is everybody, could be everybody, and depending on all the scenarios. So I know it's confusing, but I hope that will help as you read through these terminologies. And through our terms and conditions, that might help understand where we were going there. And you will also notice that we put the definitions in WAC. That is for consistency. We want all of the terms or the definitions to be consistent across all data contracts. So speaking of data contracts, because we're doing this stakeholder input, we will not be negotiating contracts. We have done that in some instances with people in the past. We are doing this for a couple of reasons. One, to gather everybody's stakeholder input up front. Everybody will have the same terms and conditions as everybody else, with a few exceptions. So, for example, there are some terms and conditions requirements that might apply to driving records versus vehicle records, and vice versa. If you are a public entity versus a private entity, there might be a few differences there, but generally speaking, everybody will operate under the same terms and conditions. It has a, especially in the private sector, it will have a effect of leveling the playing field for everyone, as well as make it much more easier on Eric's team when trying to do all these audits. We have hundreds of contracts to audit at some point, at some level. And so to have different contracts and different terms and conditions isn't working for us. So, so please provide your input. That's what this is for. The rewrite of the contract, you'll notice some things that have changed. So the data licensing statements, we've moved some things that are specific to a particular data service or a particular type of data to the data licensing statement so that the general terms and conditions are consistent across all contracts. Some of those requirements, like for those who are required to do audits for driving records to make sure that release of interest was signed, that would, you know, that would be moved into the data licensing statement for driving records. For the most part, though, what we've done is tried to not just to kind of memorialize our current practices. We are not changing a lot of the requirements themselves, although there are some, and we will try to go over those for you. We have done a lot of rewrite. As we've gone through audits, we have learned that sometimes we didn't write a clause as clearly as we had intended to, or it could have been interpreted a couple of different ways, that kind of thing. So we're trying to do that rewrite so that it's clearer about what our requirements are and that everybody can understand better. There are a couple contract requirements changes that I would like to try to go over, and Eric will go over some as well. We are now looking at requiring cyber liability insurance. It is a new requirement, and the clause that you have in the contract right now, the template, is the old version. We are still working on trying to figure out how to do this. And once we have a new clause drafted, we will share that as well for stakeholder input. Our intent is to do it on a sliding scale. So if you get a handful of records per year, you would likely not be required to have the cyber liability insurance. And then as this, you know, the more records you get, the higher the requirement will be. And we are looking at that it would be the number of records you have on a person. So, for example, on driving records, you may pull a record on a monthly basis throughout the year to ensure that you've got the most current information on them, but you're only doing it on one person. So that would count as one record over the course of the year. It would not count as 12 for the purposes of cyber liability insurance. There are some things that we're also considering where we might be able to mitigate that. And we're considering some factors where maybe if you recently had a data security audit with us and whether there was deficiencies or not, if you had deficiencies, they were all corrected, no deficiencies at all. If you have other things, we're still trying to figure out what that is, but then we might be able to require a lower level of the cyber liability insurance. So still looking at that. And when we have something more solidified that we can share with you and get your input on, we will certainly do that. One of the new requirements as well is, and some of you already do this, but it will be a system requirement. When you request the record, and this is for the bulk data customers, not the e-service customers at this point, but the bulk data, we were going to ask you to, you'll be required to both submit the subrecipient's name and the permissible use. Again, that's for transparency reasons, and the customer name if the customer is not receiving the protected personal information. We believe that our residents have the right to know where their data is being used. And sometimes if they see the name of a data broker, they don't really understand that that data broker shared the information on with their employer, for example, or their insurance company. They don't recognize the name of the data broker. So that's why we're asking for that requirement. And then I mentioned earlier, the subrecipient versus customer, we are going to ask for, like, example, on the subrecipient list, it'll be the subrecipient and customer list. Okay, I think I've covered that page. Eric, would you like to discuss compliance changes?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Debbie. So in compliance, one of the things I want to lay out as a foundation, between the RCWs, our state statutes, the new WAC, the new rules in our contract, we have a theme, which is basically we're handling data on behalf of our customers, our residents, in a way that reflects a privacy framework. So you'll see themes about data minimization, data retention, the shortest time possible, conducting audits, and so forth. So that results in many of the requirements that you now see in the contract. And at the end of the day, that's what my team is responsible to enforce, hence our compliance program. Some things I want to point out. First off, we have a number of preemptions. There's a couple of things that arise over time, one being that we're being asked to sign a non-disclosure agreement to protect the information that we're accessing when conducting an audit or an investigation. By entering into this agreement, you basically accept the fact that we have access to your audits without having to sign a non-disclosure agreement. And if the wording in the agreement is not to your satisfaction, and you think you would still need us to sign an NDA before stepping into your audits, then we need that input because the requirement to sign an NDA causes delay, and it's one that we're hoping to avoid. The other piece there is the exemption from disclosure. This is, we have a Public Record Act, and it exempts from public disclosure data security audits. And we've had a number of our entities attempt to claim that they don't have to disclose their audit to us because it's exempt. And so we're removing that as well. You're going to see that there's a piece in here on privacy requirements. And what this has done is we've encompassed data security, permissible use, and privacy into one umbrella set of requirements. And again, this gets us back to this idea of a privacy framework where you have security, permissible use, and so on. Some of the biggest changes you're going to see here, we want you to have privacy policies. We want you to understand the significance of protecting this information that we're sharing. Again, our job is to give our residents confidence that every step of the way where their data is being accessed, it is secure from harm. Next, data disposal is one that stands out. What we're after here is that we want you to keep the data for as short a time as possible. Once it's been used for the purpose that you requested it, it needs to be removed. And so we're looking for you to have a pretty tight policy on how long you're going to keep the data for business use. And that's what we'll be auditing against. One of the big pieces here pertains to the Fair Credit Reporting Act, FCRA, FCRA. We've often heard that the FCRA is caused to keep data for a long period of time. We are taking that away as a basis to retain data. There must be a sound legal basis for you to retain data, not on the off chance that you're hoping to protect yourself from a lawsuit. Audits. Previously, we had audits defined under the terms and conditions. Now we've attached attachment D, D delta, to the agreement. And so we've tried to lay out a couple of things. One, we're letting you know the objectives of the audits. We're letting you know what each audit will be testing you for. And it raises information about corrective action plans. An important note here is on the annual statement of compliance. This is where we are also then going to enforce a corrective action plan. So whether you're a bulk customer or an e-service customer, you generally need to provide us with an annual statement of compliance, and this is where we'll be enforcing those as well. Other big things that pop out, we will be invoicing now for the review of data security audits. The statutes have always read that the department is not responsible for the cost of the audit, and we've always absorbed our internal cost to review the audit. And with the new WACS and with the new contract, we will be invoicing for that. Now, I want to point out that our invoices are typically in the neighborhood of four figures. And while that may sound like a lot, I'm going to point out that many states charge for their audits, and we hear stories of them charging five to six figures for their audits. So we believe that the work we're doing is due diligence, it's reasonable, and the prices will be as best we can do. The attachment does lay out those areas that we'll be invoicing for. So again, we're looking for your comments and feedback on that. One of the biggest things here, when you have subrecipients, and one that I'm sure is going to cause a little bit of heartburn, historically we've had this aspect that you're required to pass through the requirements as they pertain to securing data, or the PPI is the term we use now, protected personal information, where you pass that PPI through to a subrecipient. We want you to pass through the requirements, and we've had a whole number of versions of reasons why that's been successful or unsuccessful. We want to make it simple. And I know it appears burdensome if you're keen on this topic. A six-page addendum seems like a heck of a task. But we want to make it very clear on what requirements you need to pass through in your agreements with your subrecipients. I expect we'll have no shortage of feedback on this one, but that's the intent. We want to remove any doubt on what we want you to pass through to them. So That's a big one. I look forward to your comments on that. One last comment I'm going to make real quick. It's a couple of comments. One, we have a new type of audit for those of you with subrecipients on drive records. We used to call it a desk audit or a subrecipient audit. We now call it a consent audit, where we're looking to see that you obtained the authorized consent from the named individual. And we'll be doing that, whether it be a bulk agreement, an e-service agreement, and so on. But that's the consent audit. We're also making it very clear that you, when you have subrecipients, need to audit your subrecipients. And we are not defining the term audit when it comes to that. Rather, we want you to do what a reasonable person would interpret, that you did some due diligence to make sure that your subrecipients were in compliance with the Washington addendum. So there's no expectation that you're requiring a SOC 2 Type 2 audit, but instead, it's got to pass what I call a straight face test, that you did some due diligence. So happy to answer any questions later and so forth. But that's a rough outline of the compliance pieces and some of the requirements that you'll find in the contract. So with that, back to you, Debbie.
Thanks, Eric. We are, I want to make sure I got the mouse in the right spot, moving on to our Q&A section, and appropriately, we've got a queue. And so, Eric, there's a question in the chat related to the slide that you were just on. Would you like me to read that for you?
I see it, if that's the question from William. Is that right?
Yes.
Consideration being given to having an itemized invoice. Whoa, that just changed. Stand by. Okay, so for those of you on the phone, this is the question. Is there any consideration being given to having an itemized invoice option, or perhaps an itemized list available upon request? When we've had issues with discrepancies in the past, we have been unable to identify which user was at fault for corrective action. Let me think about this for a second, make sure I understand it properly.
While he's thinking about it, I do want to point out that the answers that we're going to give here today are just the verbal answers are preliminary until we can do a formal review of all the questions and make sure that we understand the question, you know, that kind of thing. So look for your FAQ coming to formally answer the questions. But I think both Eric and I have a relatively good grasp on what our intentions are. So hopefully we'll be able to give you a good, solid answer.
Okay. So to the question from William Monroe, I think the idea of an itemized invoice is doable. It's a sound suggestion and one that we will look at so that you know which parts of it which parts of the invoice pertain to which activity on our part. So we'll take that under advisement. And then to the comment that you've had issues with discrepancies in the past and being unable to identify which user was at fault for a corrective action, I need some more color on that one or some additional information to understand if that's a question or just a statement. And William, if you're there, you can maybe come off mute and talk to me about that one real quick.
Sure, Eric. Thank you. I apologize. That wasn't perhaps very clear. The topic of audits brought me to our use log, so our lookup log that we maintain. We've got 14 employees, and at one point, all of us had access and utilized the service. We failed an audit a couple years back because somebody must not have logged something or something like that. So since then, we have checked. We get an invoice. It's for $4.10 or whatever. So it wouldn't be that $4.12. We divide that amount by 4 cents. We know how many searches we did, and then I compare that to how many searches are logged, But if there's a discrepancy, I don't have a way to find out who did a search that wasn't logged.
Okay.
And that's a problem because obviously we need to correct that person's use of the program.
So is that in an e-service?
It is.
An administrator, I believe, should have the right to see what everybody looked at. And so there's some user guides on that. Susan, can you?
Debbie, this is Susan. No, CPS, that is one option CPS does not provide. But the people on our side that doing the audits, they could provide the information to the administrator. We can run a report here and provide it to the administrator.
That's correct.
Thank you.
I'll mute myself in just a moment. Is it possible to request that prior to an audit? So if I recognize, in January we had a discrepancy, I'd like to audit ourselves. Is that possible?
Yes, you can just submit a request to our data services group box.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, we can help
with that.
By the way, I'd like to introduce Susan Mitchell. Many of you probably have worked with her on the e-services side. She is a lifeline for a lot of our e-services folks. And so appreciate that you're here today, Susan, to help us answer the questions. She is much more a subject matter expert on the e-services than I am. So I also
wanted to say, I do believe that we have that on our list of to-dos to add that function, that the administrators have that ability, because that is on some of our other e-services. Like I believe DAPS and DS has ability. So we do have that on our to-do list to add that to CPS.
Great. Thank you. So just so you know, we have a long list of things that we would like our IT department to do to improve our data services. And unfortunately, right now, they are very shorthanded and have quite a large backlog of work to do, including some really high priority stuff like implementing legislation. So we don't anticipate that our staff is going to get any attention soon, but that doesn't mean we're going to let go of the idea. We'll still be pushing to have our stuff done. Just when our IT staff team is back staffed up and they've caught up on their backlog. So thank you for your patience on that. Okay, next question from James. If I can paraphrase, because it's kind of a long question, you guys, it looks like you use contracted plate search and get charged with a 4 cents a record, but you often request very few records, and so you get, you know, these tiny bills. We can certainly work. We do have some that we bill less frequently than monthly, like quarterly or something like that. We can work with the accounting department on that. Also, the other question on that was, can we just not charge if there's, you know, a minimum amount of records? We'll have to look into that. We are required to charge fees in some areas. And so I would have to look into that to see what our flexibility is there. But it might be a good idea. Jason, did that kind of answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thanks. Carol. Oh, okay. What's the Carol's asking what the difference is between a bulk customer and any service. So, yeah, it's not really about the volume, although the term bulk kind of implies that. It's really how you get your data. So, an e-service is almost like an app. Maybe that you log directly in to our service, whether it be contracted plate search, driver record request, abandoned vehicle reporting. You log directly into our system and you can request the record or do whatever you're doing directly in our system. The other, the bulk is either a web interface or a SFTP process where we generate the file, put it out on the secure site, and then the customer picks it up from that and then uses the data from there. So that's kind of the two differences. I hope, Carol, did that help you understand? A thumbs up or a... Okay. Okay, well, I'm going to move on.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'll take the next one.
Okay.
If I may. So this is from Alex, and it talks about the, you know, the five-figure range on invoices when conducting audits. And in this question, the concern that, you know, City of Tacoma, would they be paying, you know, thousands of dollars or more for us to perform an audit when they only request a small number of records each year? So I want to point out, when I throw out those figures earlier, that's when we audit the larger, the bulk data recipients, where they are required to undergo a data security audit, permissible use audit, every few years. The e-services that perhaps you're referencing, we have the discretion, and you see that in the contract template. We have the discretion to conduct an audit, but it's a risk-based approach. Day in, day out, it's going to be simple. Submit your annual statement of compliance, because there's just no way for us to audit thousands of e-service customers on a practical basis. So we would do it on a risk base. If we had cause because of some large risk that we encountered, there would be a series of discussions. At the end of the conversation, it could lead to an audit, but I would suggest that the probability of us auditing an e-service to the tune of $1,000 or more is very, very, very low.
Thank you. Eric, the next question is probably for you as well. Can you please clarify why federal law, FRCAA, does not, or data retention requirements aren't necessary when other jurisdictions require it?
A great question, and one that we've debated with folks the last several years. Our read of the FCRA, in conjunction with opinions that we've received from counsel in the Attorney General's office, is that we don't find a data retention requirement in federal law. We see there's a disposal requirement to dispose of the data, but it speaks to the technology used so that the data is rendered unrecoverable, but there's no timeline that we can find. And on this topic, in the absence of us seeing definitive statutory guidance from the federal agencies on this topic, we are inputting our take on the matter. So if there is citations that we can see, if there is a specific that can be brought to our attention, we will absolutely consider it, but we're unable to find that at this point. So that's our approach when it comes to retention and disposal of the PPI.
Yeah. So with that, if I may just kind of add is then we have to rely on the data has a permissible use. Once that permissible use has been accomplished, you know, you've got the driving record, you've made your hiring decision, or, you know, for parking purposes or whatever you're using the data for, then that permissible use has been met and the data is no longer retained. Now, in the case of, I'm going to clarify that a little bit. So, for instance, in parking or tolling, you know, you may need that data a little longer to actually collect from the person. That's fine once you've collected or cleared out that, you know, record or account or something, or excuse me, account, then that record can be deleted. So
I'm going to take onto that if I can.
Yeah.
Subject to legal record retention requirements. So like in Washington, public agencies have record retention requirements. So that would factor into that conversation as well.
That's a good point. Thank you. Okay. So next question also for you, Eric. How often will the audits be done?
So there's two types of audits. And then let me break this out. There's two types of customers that we're recipients. We have our e-services and we have our bulk data. Let me speak to the e-services first. We consider the annual statement of compliance, where that's a requirement in your contract, a type of audit. So we are testing for compliance and looking to get your acknowledgement to that fact. Going back to the question we had earlier from City of Tacoma, it's a risk-based approach. If we see problems that warrant a further investigation, that could trigger a more in-depth audit. But for e-services, think of the annual statement of compliance as the audit. On the bulk data side, where we are required to conduct the audits, we have followed the practice from our Office of the Chief Information Officer, where state agencies are required to do a triennial or an audit every 3 years. So we've borrowed that as a best practice, but the bulk data recipients will note that again, here we're looking at a bit of a risk-based approach, and where we can identify lower risks, we are willing to extend that. We will extend that out to 4 years. However, where we see high risks, it could be every 2 years. So we're looking for about a median 3 year, but figure it's no more, I should say, no less than at least once every 4 years for the bulk data recipients to have both a permissible use and data security audit.
Thank you, Eric. Elizabeth is asking, we use e-services, law enforcement, and I'm unable to see what each user pulls, so will we be able to get more access to review? Elizabeth, may I ask what e-service you're using?
Yes, it's DAPS.
Okay. Susan, can you help me with that? Is it just administrators that can see, or is it managers as well?
I believe it's just administrators.
Okay. So that's a limitation in the system. If you need to see what users are pulling, ask your administrator to pull that report. At this point, I don't think we have an intent to expand that to see. But if you see that there might be a need for managers to have that, we could look into it. Again, it would probably be quite a while from now because of our IT resource issues. Karen, please clarify your position of changing or charging for reviewing of the data security audits. Eric, you want to?
Yeah. So just to continue the question there, is that isolated to reviewing IT data security audits, or are you intending to charge for the 3 year permissible use audit? So we already charge for the permissible use audit. And that's something that we've done since day one. Now, that's the time that we have spent when conducting the audit. So there's a description of that in the audit table under cost of audit. It lays out the things that we would be invoicing for. And then it would also then apply to the data security audits as found in that first column of detail in the table. So to answer, both types of audits will be invoiced.
And again, that is because the statute now requires that we are not responsible for the cost of the audit. Question from Alex. I missed a zero in my previous question. $10,000 audit?
So that's a worst case scenario. We've seen the, again, this would go back to when we're doing the work. And when we've been doing the work, the audits have been in the range of three to, when we're not traveling, it's in the neighborhood of three to four, I would even say $5,000. That's on the permissible use side. We haven't invoiced for a data security audit yet, so we don't know what that's going to look like, but I imagine it's going to be similar.
it really, I think part of it also in for at least data security, it would depend on the complexity of the environment, how much you're getting. For example, we have some recipients who get multiple types of data, driver, vehicle, vessel data. So they use e-services and bulk data interfaces. And so, you know, the bigger the and the variety of data, the bigger the audit. So can we get an estimate invoice prior to signing up, as we have to get approved prior to budgeting and asking for money? Is that related to, I assume that's related to the audit question.
Yeah, and we can do that. Again, it's going to be based, as Debbie just pointed out, size of the system, number of records pulled, et cetera. So we can give a range to give you an idea. And that's one of the things that we've been trying to get this out now, is so that those who are developing their budgets in the coming year, I don't see us invoicing for the data security audits until next year, 2023, when this gets up and operational. So there's time, and yes, we can provide an estimate.
And since we now have done some permissible use audits, several of them, I think we would be better at estimating them than we were prior to ever doing them before. So let's see. Jason, you're welcome. Paula, I have kept all the driving records I have run in a locked cabinet. So you're stating I need to shred all the records? This is for employees. Okay. You're doing work in Israel. Could you explain? Okay, so for employment purposes, you know, I'm going to have to research that one. Do you know the answer to that one, Eric?
I don't, other than I would defer to what the legal requirements are.
Yeah.
If it's your policy to keep the records, we would look for a law to back that up, because we are going to insert that our contract may trump a discretionary decision espoused in a policy at year end. So it's going to depend.
So for example, if you've got driving records of commercial drivers, there might be some transportation laws. Well, Israel, I don't know, but like FMCSA or U.S. Department of Transportation might require that you keep those records while the person's employed or something like that. So you would have to defer to whatever this requirement is.
And if that doesn't answer it, Paula, please let us know.
Okay.
Next question was, DS is service?
It is. It is a service that is specifically designed for courts to use, to interface with us, to adjudicate records, to submit forms to us, that kind of thing. We do have a couple of other types of users in that system. Especially since we've added more functionality to the service. But yes, Diaz is an e-service.
I'm going to take the next question. This is from John. Can you clarify for me, please? They have a group of 3 to 4 officers using DAPS, which is our driver and plate search, used by law enforcement primarily. And they request registered owner information on approximately 8,000 to 10,000 times a year. Does that mean we are subject to thousands of dollars worth of audits? In a worst case scenario, yes. Practically speaking, no. Again, in the DAPS being one of our e-services, We are going to lean on the annual statement of compliance. I go back again, if the risks are there, we would talk to you and go down that path of doing an audit. In my 5 years being with the program, we have never conducted an audit or had cause to conduct an audit on an e-service customer. So this is one of those things that you see in a contract. It gives us the right, but the odds of us exercising that are limited.
A question from Elizabeth related to DAPS and law enforcement and the retention of the records. For governmental entities like law enforcement, we rely on you to follow your record retention policies for keeping the record. So, you know, each state governmental entity has a requirement to have record retention policies for that. Please rely on those.
Yep. And we accept those. I'll just say we accept that.
Yes. This is from Matt. Did I understand from your statement earlier that when personal information is gathered, that person must be informed of the access of their information?
I suggest a consent requirement.
Yeah, not necessarily. There are some instances. So for an attorney or an investigator requesting vehicle owner information, for example, we have to notify them that the record was given to an attorney or an investigator. We don't say who. There are and have been several privacy bills introduced both at the federal and state level. And we are anticipating that that's going to be a contract or a legal requirement at some point, but we are kind of getting ahead of that and requiring it now that you let us know who that record is for so that the owner of that record can have transparency about how their data is being used. We don't, except for the case of where legal consent is required or the attorney investigator scenario that I just mentioned, we don't typically proactively email anybody and say, hey, you know, so-and-so pulled your record for insurance underwriting or anything like that. But if they call and ask us, we want to be able to tell them how their data is being used. From Karen, I apologize if you already covered this, but I recall seeing in the summary that there is a $20,000 civil penalty. How do we see that penalty? How do you see this penalty being applied? Yes, there is. We've always had criminal penalties in law for the misuse of data. Now, under our new legislation, there is up to $20,000 civil penalty per incident. An incident is defined in the WAC.
Thank you. Oh, it is.
Yeah. And so we are still developing our processes around that, doing some research about how other agencies assess those penalties, working with our AG's office. So we don't have really anything built yet about how that would be assessed. But I believe what our intent would likely be first is, you know, education first. You know, this is for someone who is blatantly, intentionally, you know, negligently using the data. We find that misuse often is just a mistake or they didn't understand. It was kind of an innocent thing, whatever. So we have found that education solves the problem. And I think that's where we will go first. But for the civil penalties, it would really have to, you know, rise to a level higher than, you know, just a mistake or something like that, or a misunderstanding or something like that. But when we have that, I believe we will be getting stakeholder input once we have that process outlined and identified. Let's see. Can I pay the invoice using a credit card? It depends. And I'm trying to think here. Most of our e-services do not allow a credit card payment. So we have one of the things that we would love to have in, for example, driver record request, is that when you do that record, instead of doing the ACH, that you'd be able to put in credit card information and pay that way. That is one of those system updates that we've been waiting for since the beginning, since DRR was created. We're hoping to have that in the future at some point. I'll have to research the rest of this with our accounting department, but if I recall, I had a conversation, it's been years now, with our accounting department that they did not have the capability to accept credit cards at headquarters. Let's get updated information on that, because I know you can go into a licensing office and use a credit card if you're renewing your driver's license or something like that. Let us get you in updated information on that one. Okay, thank you, Paula, for that clarification that it is Israel's, not my policy. Yeah. Yeah, so if you're following a law, you have to follow the law. Driving records, not DOT or CDO. Okay, another question. Will it be mandatory for customers to have cyber liability insurance, which would include e-services customers? Some e-service customers may be required to have it. We're still working out that scale. But I believe most e-services folks will not. Because you don't raise to that level of getting enough records. There are a few who are heavy users of the e-services, and they might fall under that. But again, it would be a scaled approach. So you may not have to have the $10 million worth of insurance. Maybe you have, you know, the bare minimum amount of insurance required. Sorry, my thing jumped. For cyber liability insurance, do you have a single agency in mind, or would we have to have an agent that handles that type of insurance? We cannot recommend any kind of insurance company. We would just tell you what the requirement is. You can use your insurance broker. There are some requirements that it be insurance agent licensed to do business in Washington and have a certain rating. That those requirements are already in the insurance requirement clause, and we don't anticipate that change. They have to have like A-minus rating or something like that. Those requirements aren't changing, but yeah, you would just use whoever you choose. Okay, and then Carol's not, mic's not working. So, did I skip any questions accidentally? Because my little thing was scrolling up and down.
I think that's everything that I see.
So. Great. I will pause just to see if anybody else wants to ask any other questions. Before we go on to our closing remarks, I will reiterate again, this meeting is being recorded. For those who I noticed throughout the meeting, people were jumping on. could be that you lost connection and you came back on, but we were asking for folks, if you haven't already, type your first and last name into the chat. We're required to document that for recorded meetings. And also, I'll just reiterate that out of all these questions and comments, we will be developing frequently asked questions and distributing that out as it gets updated. We do have a webinar tomorrow, and we'll likely may see some of you back. I don't know. We will. If you can't come back tomorrow, that's fine. We'll capture the questions, you know, and put them in our frequently asked questions.
Hello. Excuse me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Unfortunately, for some reason, I cannot use the chat box, so I cannot put in my name.
Okay. I can see your name on the screen, so we're good to go.
Perfect.
Yeah, I appreciate your diligence on that.
Thank you.
Check. When will we hear from you on our new contract? Okay. So in a minute or so, James is going to go over next steps and that process. Is the webinar tomorrow going to cover the same stuff? The opening will be the same. The questions may vary because the people may vary. But again, we will capture those in our frequently asked questions. Some of the questions will be similar. So we may not use them verbatim in the FAQ, but we'll try to capture everything in both the question and the response, especially the response. Using these services, do you have to have cybersecurity? Well, it depends on that. If you are just using our system, you are logging into our system, and I believe the security covers that. If you print out a hard copy, there are security requirements for that hard copy. Earlier it was mentioned that they keep it in a locked cabinet, that kind of thing. The privacy requirements do outline those types of requirements that you have to have. If you turn around and you put that data in another system, you get it off e-services, you turn around, you enter it into another system, that system will have to have meet the security requirements. Yes. If you look at it in our system and you don't print it, you don't copy anything down, you just look at it and leave it right there, our system will cover you. My thing has been moving, so I'm hoping to capture everybody. The annual audit for Diaz is usually in July, correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
It's a summertime when Christy Leroy will be reaching out, as they've done.
Thank you. Is the webinar tomorrow at 9:30 or 8 o'clock, as you mentioned earlier?
And James answered that below.
Oh, thank you, James. It's 9:30. I misspoke. Does DOL provide a privacy and security contact so that we can put our IT people in touch with DOL for questions and ensuring our approach will achieve compliance?
Short answer to that is no. We take the approach of we tell you the what, you determine the how, and we are happy to have a conversation with you to determine in advance of what you're proposing would normally satisfy the requirement. So happy to have that conversation. But as far as more of a consulting service, we're not going to provide that. We have reservations about ever endorsing someone's plan. Because in the event you do follow that plan and something happens, then it could point back to us that the deficiency is our fault because we endorsed the plan. So unfortunately, we don't have a point of contact on that. Sorry.
But if you need clarification on what the requirement is, happy to do that as well.
Yeah.
And it would be, if you have questions about that now, we'd like to hear about it now so that we can make those clarifications in the contract template up front so that everybody has the benefit of that same information. Yes. So the next question is, can you or James please speak to timeline for going live executing new templates? Yeah, that's part of James Talking's points coming up. You know what? I'm just going to go ahead and I'll still watch for questions, but this is the next screen. So you can see that we will be talking about next steps, the new application process, effective dates, that kind of thing.
Debbie, you want me to just go ahead and start with the...
Looks like we just got a couple more questions, so let's try to answer those. As a requester for an employer, will we be given a contract? So the people that we provide a contract to, who contract directly with us, if we go back to the, you know, recipient versus requester versus subrecipient, anybody who gets data directly from us will have a contract with us. In many cases in the e-services, it'll be a click to agree, which you've already clicked to agree on. Contracted plate search is still a paper contract, paper digital contract now, since we don't have WEC signatures anymore. Thank you, COVID. But we are hoping to move to a click to agree for the contracted plate search as well as the abandoned vehicle reporting. Anybody else who gets the data from another person, a recipient, an agent, that kind of thing, another subrecipient, you should be getting a contract from the entity that you're getting the data from. That is a requirement that we have, that as the data gets cascades down, whoever we give the contract, we give the data to, they have a contract with us. If they gave the data to somebody, they have a contract with that person. If they gave the data to somebody else, then there's a contract there. There are some exceptions to that. So, for example, for CDL drivers, and the acronym, in case you're not familiar with it, commercial driver's license, CDL. You know, if someone is, an employer is sharing the driving record with a regulatory body such as FMCSA or U.S. Department of Transportation, State Patrol, whoever, that's allowed. That's not data sharing. That's just following your, you know, your compliance pieces. It looks like my screen somehow went away. Yes, I'm sorry. Let me share the screen again. Sorry about that. Well, and James, can you see that?
Yeah, I can.
PowerPoint. Okay. Somehow I lost it again. Still yet another question. For those who could not attend the webinar, when would the video be available to see? I would imagine next week. We would ask that you request that. We don't have a place to post it right now. So if you want to get a copy of the video or both videos from both webinars, please email our group box datacontracts@dol.law.gov and we'll get that for you as soon as they're available. Okay, James, go ahead and take it away.
Sure. Thanks, Debbie. So just wanted to start off by telling everybody that we do appreciate all the comments and questions today. We want to conclude this meeting by talking about next steps in the process. So we are requesting all feedback you received by close of business on March 4th for bulk contract customers. Please send your feedback to datacontracts@dol.wa.gov. And for e-service customers, send your feedback to dataservices@dol.wa.gov. The DOL will review all feedback and make any applicable changes to the documents. Once all feedback has been received, we will go ahead and develop and distribute an FAQ. For the Washington Administrative Code, there is a three-phase process for rulemaking. We are currently finishing up CR 101, or phase one of the rulemaking process, which is to invite the public to participate in discussion of possible rulemaking before any formal notice or action is taken. We'll be moving into CR 102, which is the proposal of rulemaking. In CR 102, we will be holding a public hearing and will notify you a minimum of 20 days in advance of the public hearing and do encourage you to participate in that. Once we have completed this phase, we will move into CR 103, which is rulemaking adoption. After the rule is approved, the rule is filed with the Office of the Code Revisor to be put into effect. Our goal is to have the new Washington Administrative Code adopted for a November 1st effective date. As for contracts, we will be requiring new applications, which must be updated and complete. We will notify you when we're ready to begin accepting applications, which we anticipate will be sometime in spring. The applications will be processed on a first-come, first-served basis. If an application is incomplete, it'll be sent back for corrections. We will begin issuing new contracts this summer with an effective date of November 1st, 2022. After hearing the overview of the draft contracts and WAC and listening to other feedback, you may have additional questions or concerns, which we do invite you to attend our second webinar scheduled for tomorrow, 9:30 to 11 a.m. Pacific time. We do want to thank you all for taking the time to be here today, and we appreciate any feedback that you provide.
James, I see a question from Sean. What is phase two? Is that, Sean, could you clarify that was, James already covered that, or which phase two are you?
So that's, I think they're talking about the CR 102 phase two, yeah. The public hearing.
Great. Yeah, so that's a public hearing. We'll give everybody notice for that. Yeah, okay, good. That was the WAC process. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Once again, thank you so much for participating in this process. I'm really happy to see that you guys are engaged and have questions about this. This will really help us make both the WAC and the contract template a better things for us all to have to live by. So if I see you tomorrow, I'll see you tomorrow. Otherwise, we'll keep you posted on how we go through this process. Thank you very much.
Hey, Debbie, one question came in.
Yes.
There's a question about cannot make tomorrow's session, and would that recording be available?
Yes.
My suggestion is the answer is yes. Just please, when you request a copy of today's, make sure you note that you want a copy of the second one as well.
Yes. Which dates? Yep. Both or one or the other?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.